Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast presenting three men who are at present not solely in charge of preserving humanity as a species, which is probably a really good thing.
Are you sure?
I'm certain of all things. All right, what are we reading today?
Children of Time by Adrian Jacosky.
Awesome. What is it about?
From the back of the book. A race for survival among the stars. Humanity's last survivors escaped Earth ruins to find a new home. But when they find it, can their desperation overcome its dangers? Who will inherit this new Earth? The last remnants of the human race left a dying Earth, desperate to find a new home among the stars, following in the footsteps of their ancestors. They discover the greatest treasures of the past age, a world terraformed and prepared for human life. But all is not right in this new Eden. In the long years since the planet was abandoned, the work of its architects has borne disastrous fruit. The planet is not waiting for them, pristine and unoccupied. Your new masters have turned it from a refuge into mankind's worst nightmare. Now, two civilizations are on a collision course, both testing the boundaries of what they will do to survive. As the fate of humanity hangs in the balance, who are the true heirs of this new Earth?
Excellent. Kevin, what did you think?
I liked it. There were definitely some challenging parts in it.
Okay, moving on.
Well, I'm going to spoil this little tiny bit, which is, if you don't like spiders, don't read this book.
Right. Should really have been called The Spiders from Mars, except they're not from Mars. Okay, Barry, what did you think?
I really enjoyed it. It was a very wide-reaching book.
Absolutely. Yeah, I liked it too. For me, it was sort of like, okay, you've got uplifted spiders, you've got the near end of all of humanity, you've got a psychotic main character who refers to everybody as monkeys. I mean, really, how can you go wrong?
Yes.
You stupid primate.
Exactly. So, yeah, I thought it was a lot of fun. And, you know, it sort of depends on your outlook. This is either a really depressing book or a fun romp through exactly what you want.
I thought it was pure awesome.
Exactly. Which is probably some kind of personality test that we've all failed.
Or passed in a horrible way.
Yes, I believe.
I leave the tortoise on its back.
Thank you. Reaction time is a factor. Moving on. So what did we think about the narrator? We've decided we want to talk a bit more about our narrators. And this one is narrated by Mel Hudson.
Isn't it actually Melanie?
Well, it's originally specified as Mel Hudson, but a very careful search, as in typing her name into Google, yields her name as Melanie, and she is half of the BBC radio show Hudson and Pepperdine. Anyway, what did we think of her reading?
I think she did a great job.
Yep.
Indeed.
There's a lot of different characters in this, and have to have a lot of different sort of voices, and so probably an improv comedian is a good choice.
I think she did a fantastic job with Kern's voice.
Yes.
It evoked a lot of crazy that you experience.
Yeah. It reminded me a little bit of, occasionally in an audiobook you get more information than you do in an actual book, because sometimes there's...
Are you saying these aren't actual books?
an iBook.
Oh. Versus an A-book?
Versus an earbook. So
moving on.
Well, just saying that sometimes you find out who it is because you recognize their voice, because they have to match the voice correctly, you know, all throughout the book in theory for an audiobook. So sometimes they don't reveal who is saying something in a paper book when you find out ahead of time in the audiobook.
Great. I'm glad that you said that.
It happened to me at least once in this book.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Good reading. All right. Was there anything else we want to discuss in the reviews section, as opposed to reviewing the discussion section?
Well, it's pretty hard to talk about this without major spoilers, so I think I'll have to wait.
All right.
This is a fairly hard science fiction book.
Oh, yeah. It's fairly high on the Mohs scale.
Yes.
And that, for me, was a lot of its charm, and some of its charm was just the fact that Adrian Tchaikovsky sort of, once he set on a course, he kind of committed to it. You know, it's just like,
yeah, most definitely.
You know, okay. Yeah, the humans are crazy. Oh, yeah, they're really crazy. And
no, the humans are acting normal.
Right, exactly. Like I said, crazy. And, Oh, yeah, there's spiders. Oh, yeah, there's spiders. There's lots of spiders.
Yeah, I like the fact that the, you know, he goes through the evolution of the spiders in the book as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to give too much away there.
Yeah, I kind of oscillated between, wow, this is awesome with the spiders, and like, I'm really getting creeped out right now. And it kind of came down to, I couldn't listen to this book going to sleep like I did with most books. Like,
I just think of them as, you know, 8-legged cats.
Oh, God. Thank you for ruining cats for me.
Good. What else can I ruin?
I definitely learned more about spider biology in this book than, well, pretty much any other book I've ever read.
Except for The Biology of Spiders.
Which he has not read.
Which I have not read,
by,
yes,
Portia Bianca Spider.
Yes, it's often been wondered exactly why that book was written in the first person. Now we know.
Spiders, great. You love us. I mean them.
Okay, well, it's time for us to challenge each other for dominance as to who's going to rule this podcast. Let's measure legs. All right, we will return after that, for we are sci-fi.
Sci-fi?
Sci-fi.
And welcome back. Now we are going to discuss and spoil Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky, narrated by Mel Hudson. All right, so this book presents us with a little bit of what you might call Barry's dream, humanity mostly dying in an attempt for power, all of the first chapter.
It was awesome.
So do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, it was the very first chapter is basically one of my I think it actually is my favorite scene in the entire book. You know, humanity is attempting to send out, you know, vessels to repopulate other planets using a virus they clearly have not tested very well.
Oh, yeah, that was a sad thing. And you're like, really? You really didn't test us at all, did you, idiots?
Thereby exhibiting their hubris. And
yeah, it's a virus that causes major structural changes and intelligence changes to random other species. What could possibly go wrong?
Right. I mean, the idea was, oh, it'll only work on monkeys. It's supposed to look for that. But then they didn't bother ever testing on anything else except vertebrates. Yeah. And of course, planets don't have anything else like insects or spiders. So, you know, I wonder what would happen. Probably nothing. Don't worry about it.
It's stupid. It's not unrealistic. I mean, if every time that I ask, oh, why is there X bizarre invasive species here? Oh, we did it to battle the Y, you know?
Right.
Because of humans.
Right. It'll, you know, sometimes they're brought in by accident. Sometimes it's some kind of, oh, yeah, we brought these things in to kill the tree frogs. Do these things climb trees? No, but they're really scary looking, so we figured it would eat tree frogs. But these things are awake in the daytime and the tree frogs are, you know, active at night. Well, so yeah. Okay. And totally realistic.
You know, and then, you know, to spoil the rest of the first chapter, basically,
that's the section.
Yes. Thank you. You know, there's a gentleman named Sarin who basically sabotages the vessel that they're using to send off to other planets and, you know, make them habitable by destroying the engineering section.
Well, right. He was supposed to be the guy that was the volunteer, you know, to stay behind, right? And, you know, watch over the evolving species. And
well, it turns out that he's actually a member of another group of people called, was it Non Ultra Natura?
Yes, right. The Nun.
God.
The Nun, N-U-N people.
That just completely infuriated me. Like, that's one of my little things is like, you know, there always seems to be some group that's like, let's not go to the stars. Let's just do some stupid thing until the planet's destroyed by the sun or maybe an asteroid if we're lucky.
And he wasn't against going to the stars. He was just against, you know, genetically enhanced chimps and humans used, right?
He's
sort of like the you know, the faithful opposition to Khan from Star Trek, right? So he's really Kirk.
I hadn't really thought about that. This whole thing is kind of Star Trek 2 written completely sideways.
It just has more spiders and ants.
I mean, you know, yeah, I guess the Genesis planet was totally unstable, so we never got to see what the spiders looked like.
We did see some really giant bacteria.
Exactly. Okay. let's see. Then, I really liked their use of Portia, who is also the name in the book of a sort of particular individual line of spiders, though it's you know, you have to remember that probably the spiders had names for each other that was more like this particular dominance display, you know, it's probably not in human language.
I'm pretty sure it was.
Oh, okay.
They said Portia, so I'm sure that was what they really said.
Bob of the Sticky Threads.
But yes, Portia is a real spider. I'm not actually, a real spider species. It's not an actual individual spider. But it actually does have these unique abilities to basically signal spoof.
Yes.
So if I ever inflict the novel Echopraxia on you guys, which is the sequel to Blindsight, then...
More space vampires?
Yes, there are more space vampires. Yes, they go in quite a bit to exactly how Portia works and the author's theory that it actually works by sort of time-sharing its neurons, because it isn't a fast thinker, but it just sort of sits down... puzzles out this problem and sort of like, you know, waits for a long time and then suddenly seems to have the solution and, you know, does this bizarre, you know, then I'm going to skitter over here, then I'm going to go over here, then I'm going to do this particular hop. So it has these remarkable problem-solving abilities, even though it's got a very tiny brain.
Yeah, Portia's genetic line essentially was like the first to develop the ability to reason out potential effects of her actions.
Right, which makes sense.
Yeah.
Because even with so few neurons, Portia, the regular spider, is smarter than it should be. They call it the eight-legged cat.
Yeah. I mean, she is also like a half meter in size or something, too. So
right. Then, you know, right.
Fully terrifying in movie form if
scaled when it gets made. I think she's adorable.
Wait till she gets her palps on you.
Hey,
you know, as a male, I don't expect you to last long, because it's totally fine to basically eat your mate.
What a way to go. But one thing that I thought was kind of amusing, and I'm pretty sure this was a deliberate parallel, was right after we have this introduction to Portia, then we have the humans on the approaching ship trying to talk to Kern.
The last remnants of humanity.
Exactly. And they're trying to do exactly the same thing that Portia has been described doing on the planet. They're signal spoofing. They're just like, okay, well, let's play this back and see how she reacts. Let's play this signal back. Oh, okay. Let's try talking to her this way. Let's, you know, and they finally play her, get this satellite to respond more properly by playing a distress beacon at it, its own distress call back at it.
Yeah, and there's also a series of mathematical problems that they also answer.
Right.
You know, which is actually being transmitted at the planet by the satellite to determine when the spiders have actually become uplifted enough to...
Exactly.
Or what they thought were actually chimps, but not...
Right. That isn't quite so much spider-style signal spoofing. It's...
Spider style.
Yeah, it's also kind of a hard thing to say. Yeah, but also we had the ongoing theme of power plays, which happened both among the spiders and the humans.
Yes. I mean, among the humans, it's really a very vicious kind of power play. You know, there's essentially a mutiny on the Gilgamesh.
Right.
And it becomes sort of a standoff.
Yes. One thing that I... liked, although it was driving me nuts in the beginning, was the fact that the AI, well, Kern, so one of the main characters uploaded herself into a computer to be able to function over long periods of time. And but she kept on talking about, oh, I'm sending these signals to the monkeys on the planet. And they finally responded. And despite the fact that she had all kinds of options available to actually get information as to whether or not she was actually getting information from the species that she knew had been destroyed. I mean, there's no way that she was actually talking to the monkeys.
She literally watched what do they call it? The barrel? Which
right.
Barrel of monkeys was, you know, burning up on reentry.
And so there was...
She just made the assumption that someone would have sent more monkeys, I think, is what she said. She's like, someone else will send more monkeys. We got plenty.
And so, yeah, she kept on thinking, oh, well, these have to be monkeys. These can't be anything else. And despite the fact that, you know, she'd seen pictures of the planet and, you know, later on said, you know, she'd basically hidden this information from herself.
Right.
Yeah, I kind of wonder at that point if, you know, that, you know, since she had sort of melded with the AI, if... you know, one or the other or both were sort of just intentionally blinding the other side to the fact, some of the facts. And it could, I don't discount the fact that maybe they were both halves were both just, you know, hiding this from each other and, you know, sort of a kind of humorous turn, right? But
right, because it seemed to be a complicated structure. There was sort of the basic AI, and then there was Eliza, and then Eliza seemed to be closer to the melded entity, and then there was actual Kern, who or the actual upload of Kern, who had gone completely nuts and was screaming about, you know, hey, you've taken myself, you've taken my soul. Ah,
yeah, I think Eliza is actually the sort of the human like interface to the AI that was on the ship, and Kern and Eliza basically melded in some sort of interesting way,
but not completely.
But not completely. Like it was like it's like again, there's like a power struggle there, right?
Plus, I was a little unclear because initially there was specifically the upload that would wake up the human when the time was right, but later on, it certainly seemed like the human had sort of joined the mix somehow. You know, there was the, you know, was just considered more hardware for things to run on.
Yeah, I think that Kern had left a series of instructions to the AI to basically do what you need to do to, you know, keep this satellite going, and that might have been, you know, the start of her downfall.
Right.
You know, I think it just basically took her from meat space into computer space, and
the second. Always good move. Okay, after we seed the random virus on the planet, let's give an AI with general computing power, you know, blanket orders to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
Never goes wrong.
It always goes right.
Also, it wakes her up when it gets a distress signal. And this is kind of like, well, what do I do, you know, about next time to wake her up or something? Or maybe that was earlier, but it was very vague. You know, she's sort of like, well, how about when this happens or that happens? And it's just like, really? You might be in suspension for like thousands of years or something like that. And you're not even going to like spend 5 minutes thinking about, you know, more explicit, you know, factors or something. Like, just like, I don't know. Just have my AI copy do it. It'll be fine. Yeah.
So one thing that I really liked was that the spiders on the planet used the ants as a computing substrate. They basically had trained the ants to do certain things, rather like we're using trained AI algorithms to do things in neural networks and so on.
Right. It was sort of like a giant like Ant Turk machine or something.
Yeah.
Right. It was like a Babbage engine or something like that. And it was, I thought it was interesting, but then after a while, it was sort of like disturbing because you're like, so basically they decide it's okay to have this like slave
species. They're not sentient.
Yeah, that's basically what they're saying. They don't have any feelings, just like animals, like, you know.
So I'm imagining our, you know, near future where we use basically like, you know, seas of chickens to do computation.
Chicken Tron.
The chick computer.
I think I've gone to a very, very dark place.
It's basically just, you know, all chickens playing tic-tac-toe all over again.
Chicky knobs.
Yes, thinking. It's like a chicky knob, you know, tic-tac-toe nightmare.
Moving on.
There's no beak.
There is no beak.
And you must quack or something.
It has to make chewing noises as you feed it. Yeah.
Today on Kevin, chicken sound failure. But I will do I Have No Bill and I Must Quack as duck literature. Quack, quack is what ducks say, by the way, Kevin.
Huh?
Is that what sound a duck makes? What sounds do ants make?
What does the fox Scream. Say? So, yes, we had the prisoner's dilemma, and it was sort of interesting where both sides kept on assuming that, well, the other one's playing prisoner's dilemma, and so the natural option is that they have to defect. And, you know, that was contrasted to, you know, the spiders don't necessarily make that kind of either or comparison. You know, so they had found to get a third solution, which was quite interesting. You know, hey, let's board the enemy ship and inject them with a modified version of our virus that makes the humans friendly. I wasn't sure what I thought of that ending because it seemed both a really happy ending and a really sad ending at the same time. It's just like, let's rob the humans of their essential humanity.
We like the spiders now. Well, yeah, that's also kind of bothered me towards the end, because I'm like, so it's a modified version that doesn't have the uplift. It just recognizes the uplift.
Right.
So it basically means the spiders are going to continue to evolve with the uplift. And so there'll be these, you know, spider overlords, and the monkeys will just be sort of like their friendly like pet or something like that. I mean, is that what's going
to
happen?
Well, I mean, it's preferable to what we've got now.
I mean, it's almost as if, you know, the spiders turned the humans into chimps, right?
Right. They domesticated them.
Yeah. I mean,
like they did with everything, which they said, yes, we domesticated the ants instead of destroying them, you know.
Yeah. I mean, at first I thought that this might have been actually a weaker part of the story, but you know, spending some more time thinking about it and listening to the book a second time, I thought it was actually kind of amazing that someone would think of, you know, the spiders actually becoming smart enough to, you know, essentially weaponize the virus that, you know, made them as smart as they are.
Right. Right?
They were the fact that they're even aware of it.
Well, it was interesting because they basically said there are no fossil fuels because there hasn't been enough time on the planet to develop, you know, that stuff to happen.
Right.
So they had to have a completely different type of technology, you know, and energy sources. So there was a lot of like biotech stuff and, you know, like Silk Punk.
Yeah.
Well, even at the end, they had that biofusion reactor, right?
Right. And obviously they had some information from Kern, but, you know, a lot of it was their own stuff as well. You know, it's just like, what is it? The first Fabian who is basically like, oh yes, our special reprogrammable spider colony or a ant colony is sort of like these like computer things that,
right,
you know, we didn't know what the hell they were until he had that, you know, moment of revelation.
Yeah. And Fabian was an ant hacker, basically.
Right.
Okay. Let's see.
So I guess the other thing too was the concept of, you know, the human race has been essentially destroyed, right? You know, the remnants were left on Earth and in this ice age, and they were kind of slowly coming back until the ice caps in the ice age ended, and then all the pollution was released and started killing them again. And so like, oh crap, okay, now we really have to leave the planet for real. And like, and so they had, you know, they kind of,
there was no Bob to come to the rescue.
Right. So they took the remnants of the hypersleep chambers or whatever they called them in here. And
they basically sort of cannibalized the old empire, what they called the old empire, which was sort of right before they had their cataclysmic event.
Right.
Right.
One thing that I couldn't figure out was they kept on calling the language Imperial C. And as a software developer, I kept on thinking of the C programming language and wondered if they had discovered like the C programming language and thought it was a written and spoken language, like an actual human language. And so this guy was trying to talk to them and, you know, if deaf.
Yeah. I mean, I assume that it would.
Compiler macros.
It was, you know, they didn't ever say anything else, and I don't have the written version, so I assume it was the letter C and not like S-E-A
or something. I checked.
Okay, so.
I wonder if that was a short for common.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Maybe it was supposed to stand for common, but that would make sense for.
I think you said you thought it was like Kernigan and Richie C.
No, yeah, that was my bit, yes.
Yes, that probably was it.
Well, yeah, no, and then you were saying that, then K and R got corrupted to
Kaiser.
To Kaiser.
And that became Imperial. Yes.
I think we need to write that story.
It sounds like some kind of like, you know, deep lost apocalyptic thing, whatever. you know, something that they would find in Thundar the Barbarian. What is this Imperial Sea? What way to do it? Thundar's way.
Yes, well,
when he's attacking the spiders and so forth, and
exactly,
yeah. So, but anyway, so I thought that the interesting part of this was they had this sort of long term. I mean, it was a ship where everyone was in suspension, and they had the crew that would come back every 100 years or whenever to kind of do maintenance and kind of see what was going on and about, oh, we hit another planet, it woke us up, and let's see. Right. So I thought that was an interesting variant.
The classicist would be awakened every once in a while and he'd be just like, what fresh hell is this?
Yeah. He basically waking up, they say, hey, we need you to decipher something again. And then it'd be like somebody totally new half the time. And he's like, great, I'm in some weird like slave, you know, cult and like what's going on.
Right. And the last time he just could not get his, you know, nerves under control because he kept on thinking, okay, he kept on calling the guys the tribe because he was just so convinced that this was just another cargo cult that was venerating
that's
the
exactly
ship.
The word exact word I was thinking of was like he's like waking up and he's like all of a sudden he's like inducted into this cargo cult almost immediately. It's like, god damn it.
Yeah,
I thought it was also interesting that they called him a classicist and not just a historian.
Right Well, it sort of matches that they're thinking of the old empire as the same way that we think of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Right.
So, favorite scenes.
I love the first chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Just watching humanity go down the toilet all in one glorious chapter.
You must like watching the news then.
I actively avoid it a couple times a week.
Yeah, it's good uplifting. It's uplifting indeed. Makes me feel like I got viruses changing my brain. So yes, my favorite scene was the end where they're coming in, they're saying, yeah, we're going to kill these spiders. We're humans. That's what we do. That's what we're good at. And suddenly they put a web around the planet. We're being attacked by spiders. Yeah.
They've developed spacesuits.
And they're much better than our spacesuits. And they're just, you know, they're just wiping their thoraxes with us. And
yeah, I mean, I like that. I mean, that was probably my favorite line in the book. That was just sort of like, it kind of summed up the whole, you know, what they thought of humanity were, you know, what are we going to do, you know, when we find spiders on the planet? Like, just poison the fucks, scrub the planet clean. We're humans, Holston. It's what we're good at. And that's kind of like the whole history, you know, as, I mean, because Holston's recollecting a lot about, because he's sort of entrenched in, you know, the old empire and everything. And most people don't even have any idea what happened except for the broad strokes of, you know, bad stuff. And then we woke up and, and, you know, he was kind of thinking how they had kind of, you know, tethered themselves to this thought of the old empire as being sort of something to strive for as a pinnacle. And he's sort of thinking they're so focused on that they can't just do what they would normally do in trying to survive. And maybe like they would have a better outcome if they would just do what they would do without trying to reclaim past glories or something.
Right. I think I got that.
Yeah. So it's like they kept trying to emulate the old empire, even though they knew it had failed.
Right.
And they didn't really know why.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They would come across, you know, bits of technology and go like, oh, look, there's star maps. You know, we should head over here because they said they had a planet. And, you know, it's sort of like just picking up the crumbs of, you know, what was left and trying to make good decisions. But they were so, like Kevin was saying, it was so entrenched in basically repeating their past mistakes.
Then I'm thinking like, is that like, you know, people are like, oh, you know, Greeks and Romans are the pinnacle of civilization. We should try to emulate that stuff.
Right. Which is
bread and circuses. It works pretty good now.
Well, I mean, there's a certain amount of, you know, there's also a parallel with the spiders, you know, over the 2,000-3,000 years that this book covers. Right, where they kind of emulate, you know, Earth history to some degree, right, where they develop things. But the big difference is that there's a gender swap, right? The females are the dominant gender on the planet and have very little concern for the males. And, you know, there's even laws about, you know, like, oh, after you mate with the males, it's totally fine to eat them, which is true in real spiders, right? But
yeah, they
rationalize it, right? It was,
well, no one would eat you because then they would incur my displeasure.
Right. And he's like, but don't you see that that's kind of wrong? And she's like, I don't, what is your freaking problem? Stop complaining. You know, she's like, those males just, you know, they just, you know, get finicky and you just got to put up with them, whatever. And like,
don't get uppity.
Yeah. So it, there was definitely a very, you know, it was in your face for about 80% of the book, you know, of like, you know, hey, you know, this can be seen from another viewpoint.
Right.
But, you know, that's kind of not the point of science fiction. But, you know, one common thing is like it's a vehicle for social commentary, right?
Yes, it has been known to happen.
You know, their version of, you know, measuring dicks was basically measuring legs, which was explicitly stated.
Oh, sure. It's a standard species behavior. All right. Yeah. Favorite characters, or which character would you want to be? I think I would go for Fabian, just because I like the idea of just being... I like that scene where he was just like reprogrammed the ants to do whatever the hell he wanted.
Yeah.
Either that or an earlier version of Portia. I didn't really like it when she sort of turned into the High Priestess later on.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think I could be any of the spiders. I guess I have to be Holston or something. He at least survives through, as far as we know, right?
You don't want to be Kern or Lane or...
Lane, I like Lane being the engineer. I don't know that I would. I did consider, well, I could be one of the uploaded insane AIs, but I don't think I would want to consciously be that unless I didn't have a choice, I guess. I'm living forever, huh?
He still doesn't know.
Yeah. I don't know. Like at the end when they were invading, and I was thinking, well, maybe, you know, maybe they'll figure something else out. And because, you know, you don't necessarily want them to annihilate the spiders. You kind of want a fairy tale ending where, like, you know, instead of doing the whole prisoners thing, they could just be like, okay, how about we just agree? We won't kill each other and we'll just risk it. You know, in which case they would be sharing the planet or something, you know, kind of in an unsettling way. But part of me wanted it to be like the spiders would, you know, wipe out the humans. That would like send the ship down and just freaking annihilate the planet. And that would be like, you know, the just desserts for everybody is like, you know, there's nothing left except for like,
I'm experiencing
this one orbiting AI, like insane platform.
monkeys. My monkeys killed each other.
Well, I thought it was also kind of funny that, you know, Kern essentially talks about monkeys as a tool to, you know, help humanity survive, but she also uses the word as a pejorative,
right?
Which I found kind of amusing.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as character that I'd like to be, I couldn't decide between Saren, who basically was like the man,
the hero,
the man with the finger on the trigger that basically crushes humanity at the very beginning, or the Uplift Virus.
You wanted to be the Uplift Virus.
I don't see any downside to that.
At least it's a job with specific and clear instructions.
Yes. Don't let the monkeys get too smart.
That's right. We got to wipe them out when the humans get here.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So was there tea? I didn't notice any.
I don't believe that there was tea.
Oh, well, that's a strike against.
That's a strike for it.
I think they mentioned some kind of coffee substitute at one point, but I'm pretty sure there wasn't tea.
It was aphid juice.
Oh, God. Yes.
Kevin is not a huge spider fan. I'm just getting that.
Hey, look there on the wall.
The half meter ones are the ones that bother me.
Sizes.
Also highly poisonous ones, I guess. But.
So you're saying the legs are too big?
Yes.
So yes, more leg measuring. All right. So, on my way in, I decided I was going to sprinkle a little Uplift Virus on some cockroaches that I saw. So let's see. Oh, yeah, it looks like they've developed a viable form of democracy. So way ahead of anything we've ever done.
And they've got cute fur.
So I think it's time to cede the planet to them. Anyway, we will return or not, or maybe just cockroaches will return with that use our voices. For we are sci-fi.
Sci-fi.
Sci-fi.